Our final case, United States v. Moore. Counsel, when you're ready.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Jonathan Biron for the United States. There are three fundamental problems with the district court's ruling suppressing the evidence found in the warranted search of Corey Moore's apartment. First, the district court impermissibly second-guessed the reasonable inference drawn by the affiant and by the Montgomery County Circuit Court judge that who issued the warrant that Mr. Moore was a drug trafficker. That violated this court's rule that great deference must be shown to the probable cause determinations of judges and magistrates who issue search warrants. Second, the district court discounted the information in the affidavit showing that Mr. Moore was a drug trafficker because the affidavit didn't include the type of evidence, controlled buys, informant tips, and so forth, that the district court was used to seeing in such cases. As this court recently said in Monteith, to require the affiant to amass every piece of conceivable evidence before seeking a warrant is to misunderstand the burden of probable cause. Now, these two errors led the district court to conclude incorrectly that the affidavit in support of the search warrant failed to set forth probable cause. The third problem with the district court's ruling was its failure to recognize that even if the affidavit didn't set forth probable cause, the drugs, guns, money, and other items found in the search should nevertheless be admissible at trial under the Leon good faith exception. First, as to the inference that Mr. Moore was a drug trafficker, the district court recognized that one inference to be drawn from the information provided in the affidavit was that Mr. Moore was engaged in drug trafficking. I cite the court to Joint Appendix 71, when the court said that was one inference that we could draw. But then the district court suggested a few other possible inferences that could be drawn from the fact that Mr. Moore possessed a distributable quantity of cocaine and was pursued by police and discarded it. It's well settled that this court must give great deference to the issuing judge's probable cause determination, and that includes respecting the reasonable inferences that the issuing judge draws from the facts set forth in the affidavit. Here, the issuing judge could reasonably conclude that Mr. Moore was engaged in drug trafficking. First, there is the fact that he was in possession of basically a half a kilogram.
You're talking about the issuing magistrate.
Correct. It was a Montgomery County Circuit Court judge, okay. but yes.
Who issued the warrant?
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
That judge was told that on September 25th, 2010, Mr. Moore discarded approximately half a kilogram of cocaine while being chased by a police officer. A point that the court should also consider is the fact that the statutory citation from the Maryland Code that was included in the warrant, which is Maryland Criminal Law 5-612, that says that it is that a person may not manufacture, distribute, dispense, or possess certain amounts of drugs. They get an enhanced penalty, in this case a mandatory minimum of 5 years if they do. And 448 grams or more of cocaine is one of those amounts. The title of that statutory section is Volume Dealer. Now, I'm not saying that the name of the statutory section is dispositive, but that's an inference that the legislature has drawn, that someone who possesses that amount of narcotics is a volume dealer. That's certainly something that the affiant and the issuing judge could take into account. An important fact here also, Your Honors, is that he possessed this volume dealing amount of cocaine on the same block as his residence. That leads
what
to
does that tend to show?
That tends to show, Your Honor, that he was either coming from or going to his residence in possession of this cocaine. And that makes it more likely that he is a drug dealer who's going to
other cocaine or paraphernalia behind in the residence.
I think so. I think that some an officer could reasonably draw that inference, and so could the
judge. You're saying because the amount. Certainly, if he had had a gram on him, you wouldn't be making that argument, right?
Not just by sake of the quantity, but the fact that he has a distributable quantity, a substantial quantity that had $10,000 of street value, that it's reasonable to...
Was it $10,000?
Yes, that was...
The street value is $10,000?
Correct, Your Honor. That's in the affidavit.
But in the Fourth Circuit, we say that small amounts of drugs can go to the jury on a question of intent to distribute. So then there's no limiting matter there. Not you cite Maryland, but under this precedent, this circuit, that means any amount almost would be, you could say that's drug trafficking.
Well, I mean, I think...
Are you familiar with our precedent, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Goes to the jury with a very small amount, even a modicum almost. He says it's up to the jury to decide. Let them decide whether it's distribution.
Well, that would certainly, I think, only strengthen our argument, Your Honor. But I think here the facts presented was that, at least in the affidavit, that he had a substantial quantity of cocaine, and that could allow the judge to infer that this is not just, a one-time, one-off thing, but rather this person is a drug dealer, and that it's likely that additional evidence of drug trafficking will be found in his residence. Under this court's precedents in Anderson, Grossman, and cases like that, which hold that the nexus between the evidence to be found and the residence and the place to be searched can be gotten at from the nature of the items and the normal inferences you draw about where they would be found.
You know, the Supreme Court cases make the point over and over again that the purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter police misconduct. It's not to punish errors of judges, but it's to deter police misconduct. And where you get officers who actually get a warrant, the Supreme Court says over and over again, we want officers to get a warrant. We want to encourage this behavior. This is what they do. And if you knock them down for getting warrants, then they'll say, what the heck, we'll just, we'll pursue some other course. But the officer actually in the warrant affidavit here, I don't see what the misconduct is, because in the warrant affidavit, the officer actually went to the lengths of disclosing information that was not favorable to the application. And, if the purpose is deterrence, what is there to deter? I mean, are we trying to deter officers from getting warrants? Are we trying to deter officers from disclosing, putting all the facts on the table before the magistrate? I just don't see it. The district court made the observation that there were no control buys and surveillance, but as I understand it, there was only a two-day period between the time of the arrest and the time that the warrant issued, and during that period of time, wasn't the defendant in jail or in detention?
Yes, he was.
So how could there be a controlled buy, or how could there be surveillance? In fact, those kinds of things, if you say, well, we want a controlled buy or we want surveillance of some sort, well, that's just saying in order to get a warrant, you have to undertake very intrusive measures and undertake surveillance. Is that what we want to encourage? The problem I have with this case is it seems that if you say the police went off here, you encourage bad forms of behaviors, such as unnecessary surveillance, and you discourage and you penalize constructive forms of behavior, which is to get that warrant and lay the facts to the degree that you can before issuing magistrate or whatever, and let them make a decision. And I don't know, if it were different facts, I'd feel differently about it, but it's hard to believe that somebody who throws $10,000 of a drug into a dumpster while fleeing and is seen by a, not only a law enforcement officer, but by a civilian witness who have done that, and you get a landlord who identifies this as the residence he's renting, and you get the BMW parked right outside of it. And, I mean, I don't, you know, one of the things that the Supreme Court says, look, this process is supposed to be guided by common sense. And if you have drugs with that amount of street value, common sense would suggest that that's where people keep the tools of the trade in their homes. It's the most convenient place for them. Where else would they keep it? Out in the woods somewhere?
Well, that's right. That's exactly right.
Wouldn't that common sense also apply if they were in California with drugs, too? Well, you live in Virginia. I'm sure you got some at home. That would be, wouldn't it? You're going to, based on common sense, most people who are involved in some aspect of criminal activity would have some elements of it in their home, correct? There's no limiting aspect of it.
Well, there has to be evidence from which I think the issuing judge can conclude that the person's involved in drug trafficking. As Judge Keenan pointed out, if there was just, you know, one marijuana cigarette,
it
would be very different. But, Your Honor, I would say that it is possible. I wouldn't say that we couldn't get, if we knew, for example, someone was arrested with this amount of cocaine in California, and we knew, had evidence that they lived in Maryland, I'm not saying that we couldn't get a warrant based on this court's case law, but obviously that's not this case. We have Mr. Moore right outside his on the same street as his residence, where he is in knowing possession of the cocaine. So the court doesn't have to reach your hypothetical, but I think this case is much stronger.
But the police had been in the home and found no evidence of drug trafficking in his home before the warrant was issued. Is that correct?
They did a protective sweep, and there's nothing in the affidavit, at least, about the protective sweep or what they saw in it. But it came out in, I think, the pleadings in the district court that there had been a protective sweep.
And they found no evidence of drug trafficking.
Well, it's not, again, reported in the affidavit, but that is not necessarily surprising.
Wait a minute. I'm not asking you to explain the facts. I'm just asking you to confirm. Isn't that a fact that they went there, they found nothing involved in drug trafficking in the home?
Well, what I can say about that, Your Honor, is that there's just nothing in the...
You can answer my question first, and then you can say something.
There's nothing in the affidavit about that.
All right. They didn't tell them, the independent magistrate, that fact, did they?
They did not mention the protective
sweep. Don't you think that would be important in terms of whether or not his home would be some basis to be forthright? And that's what the district court felt that was very important. Normally, the district court is very smart. In this case now, of course, they granted the motion to suppress, they're not so smart. But wasn't that a factor, the fact that they didn't tell the independent magistrate that fact, which was very important?
I don't think so, Your Honor. First, for two reasons. First of all, that is not a basis for the district court's decision at all. He says he thinks perhaps it would have been advisable to put that in the warrant, but he did not base his decision to suppress the evidence on that at all. Secondly, it is
not... I thought district court said an independent magistrate reasonably couldn't in any way find that this was even a reasonable basis for issuing a warrant, didn't it?
I'm sorry?
It said that an independent, reasonable magistrate looking at this affidavit couldn't reasonably even issue this warrant.
That's what this district judge said, and of course we just disagree with that.
Right.
But
an Article III judge, correct?
I'm sorry?
Article III judge, federal district judge.
Of course, and we respect Judge Williams. I don't say that he's...
You've been calling the magistrate a judge more than the judge who this appeal is from. I noticed that.
I'm sorry?
Several times you were calling the magistrate the judge.
Well, it's a Montgomery Court, Circuit Court judge. That is the Montgomery Court judge's title.
He's saying that's a judge of a court of general jurisdiction.
I respect all of these judges, especially Judge Williams. There's nothing, please don't interpret any part of our argument as disrespectful to Judge Williams. We just think that he got this one wrong. And in terms of the protective sweep, it is not surprising that if they just did a protective sweep to see if there's anyone there still committing a burglary, that they wouldn't see, they're not supposed to look in the closets or on the shelves or in the bedroom, drawers and cabinets. That would be a violation. if they're doing a protective sweep.
They have no authority to do the things that you would with a search.
Well, that's exactly right. So the absence of information in the affidavit about seeing drugs in plain view, that's not surprising. Why it would be more surprising, frankly, if Mr. Moore would leave the apartment and leave guns and drugs in plain view that could be observed during a protective sweep.
So you want us to rule that you can search a person's home because they have that amount of drugs and they lived on the same street where they saw them?
Those are two important factors.
Anything else you got?
There's the pepper spray. I mean, there's nothing else.
Pepper spray?
There's pepper spray that's found on his person.
I think you'll find pepper spray on a lot of people in terms of who walk the street and back and forth to work. What does that have to do with drugs?
Well, I'm saying that there was nothing.
What does that have to do with drugs?
That someone who is engaged in drug trafficking and concerned about protecting a supply of drugs could have pepper spray. I'm not saying that, again, it's dispositive, but you asked me what else we have. There's other stuff. There's
My
other
goodness,
information.
You can't win. Normally, I thought drugs and guns in the Fourth Circuit said come together. Now it's drugs and pepper spray.
Pepper spray is, I'm just saying there's nothing inconsistent in this affidavit with Mr. Moore being a drug trafficker. And once the magistrate or Montgomery County Circuit Judge can reasonably infer.
The district court judge looking at this independent factual finding didn't find much credibility at all in this.
The district judge was not impressed with the warrant, but the district judge, it's not the case that the district judge can substitute his preferred inferences for reasonable ones drawn by the judge who issued the warrant. Yeah, I see my time has expired. I'd be happy to answer more questions or just come back and rebuttal.
We have no further questions.
Thank you.
Mr. McDaniel, we'd be happy to hear from you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, we're asking the court to uphold the ruling of the district court judge in this matter and understand the rule of law that's applicable as it relates to determining whether or not probable cause was found and was present in the affidavit supporting the suppressed search warrant.
No, counsel, one of the things the Supreme Court says that even if, I mean, I'm not saying there wasn't probable cause here. It seems to me to be a pretty strong affidavit, but because it's based on the personal observation of a fleeing person disposing a huge amount of drugs with a large amount of street value. But let's just suppose, arguendo, that you and I would disagree as to probable cause, perhaps. The point that United States v. Leon makes is that, you know, even if they're wrong as to that, and they proceed in good faith, that you still uphold the magistrate judge's determination. And when we look at what happened below, the district court didn't hold a hearing on this. And there's no finding here that anybody acted in bad faith. So how can we say that the officers engaged in conduct that needed to be deterred when they got a warrant and there's no finding on the part of a trial court that there's any bad faith involved?
Well, Your Honor, the district court found, as it related to the Leon issue, because it was raised in the suppression motions hearing after Judge Williams agreed that the warrant was insufficient and the evidence should be suppressed. Judge Williams found that the warrant was so lacking in probable cause that the officer's reliance upon that warrant was objectively unreasonable. And we agree with the court because of the information that was not included in the affidavit. One of the points that we made to Judge Williams and we made in our briefing in this case was that the officers, when submitting the affidavit for the request to search the premises, left out the fact that there was a protective sweep done.
There wasn't any hearing on that as to, you know, why or what the value of that was. There were no, you know, facts found as to that. And a protective sweep is generally once over lightly. It's a totally different thing from a search pursuant to a warrant.
I agree, Your Honor, but that wasn't the only context in which Judge Williams dealt with the Leon matter. In essence, what the court was saying was that probable cause that was in the court's view absent from the warrant was so prevalent, if you will, that no reasonable officer could have thought that probable cause existed in the warrant such that
the district court made the point that, well, I want certain types of evidence in order to get a warrant. And I said, I want surveillance, or I want a control by, or I want a confidential informant. But the law in this area doesn't require, it doesn't categorize bits of evidence and say it's necessary as a matter of law that there be some sort of surveillance, or that it's necessary as a matter of law. Because these cases have an infinite sort of factual variety to them. And to say that, you know, it's deficient because there are no control bys, how could that have occurred here when somebody was in detention and under arrest?
I think what the court was saying, Your Honor, is not that any one of those particular investigatory tactics or techniques were required. Just the fact that, in essence, all of them were absent was mentionable to the court.
What I'm saying is, how could they have been present given the fact that after the arrest and after the throwing of the $10,000 street value into the dumpster, the defendant was not in a position where the law enforcement could arrange a control buy. How can you arrange a control by or surveillance or CI when someone is in jail?
Well, certainly some of those techniques would have been frustrated by the fact that Mr. Moore was incarcerated during that time. I think, number one, the court was identifying those things that were absent. But to answer the court's question, there were other things that could have been included in the affidavit that were not, simply because law enforcement didn't have that information. In a number of the cases that were cited by the government in support of their contention that the nexus could be inferred from the actual arrest of an individual in possession of narcotics to that individual's address, reveal that a number of the techniques that Judge Williams was citing as being absent were present in those cases. They talked about United States versus Anderson in a case where the court did discuss the fact that the nexus was permissible, the inference was permissible, but the actual predicate was present in United States versus Anderson. What do I mean by predicate? I mean that the initial probable cause to believe that Mr. Anderson was involved with the illegal activity connected with the possession of the silencer and the involvement in the murder case, which was then being investigated. In Anderson, Your Honor, there were three different informants that had provided information suggesting that Mr. Anderson had made statements to those informants, acknowledging that he had a silencer and a firearm, and that firearm had been used in a murder. It's in that context that the court found that the information that was submitted in the affidavit was sufficient to establish the nexus. In
what's interesting with respect to your point is that some cases are stronger in some respects, in some cases are stronger in other respects. In many of those cases, the officers and a civilian didn't have the opportunity to witness somebody fleeing from them and dumping a huge amount of cocaine in a dumpster several houses away from where they lived. In other words, it's Fourth Amendment is an unusual thing because each case has its own scroll of facts, and the facts vary and differ. And yes, this didn't have a CI, but it had personal observation, which is better than a CI in some respects. I mean, you can argue it both ways, but when you apply hindsight to this kind of situation, you try to put yourself into what an officer did at the time, given the information that he had. All these people did was when they saw somebody put this amount in a dumpster and found out where they lived and found the amount, they went before a magistrate and got a warrant. Why should that be? I don't understand why that should be penalized or why that kind of thing should be deterred. What did they do wrong?
Well, no, I think, Your Honor, obviously we prefer for law enforcement to go and get warrants where they have sufficient information to substantiate the representation that's in the affidavit, that being that there was probable cause to believe that the individual was involved in the illegal activity that they say give rise to the need for the warrant. What the court was trying to avoid, Your Honor, is a scenario where the magistrate judge or any judge who's considering the issuance of a warrant is acting as a rubber stamp for the affiant. In this case, Your Honor, there was nothing to support the contention other than what it is that officer or detective, I believe it's officer, Hubley would say about his initial interaction with Mr. Moore to support the contention that Mr. Moore was in fact involved with the trafficking of narcotics. And the court mentioned those other investigatory techniques in order to illuminate what was not included in support of the government's contention that Mr. Moore was involved with the predicate act, which would then give rise to the permissible inference. In fact, the court is saying that there is no surveillance, not because surveillance is required, but because under the totality of the circumstances analysis from Gates, that would be information the likes of which would support the contention that Mr. Moore was involved with drug dealing or the trafficking of narcotics, which would then allow the inference. He says that there was no informant, not because the informant information is required, but because under the totality of the circumstances analysis, that would be information supportive of the contention that Mr. Moore was in fact involved with the trafficking of narcotics. He says that there is no hand-to-hand transaction or control by, not because that's required, but because, again, Your Honor, that would be information supporting the contention that Mr. Moore was involved with the trafficking of the narcotics. And in essence, what the court was saying, Your Honor, is that the court was troubled by the contention that anyone that was arrested in possession of an amount of narcotics, arguably an amount of narcotics that could evidence possession with intent to distribute, without more, without any additional supportive information included in the affidavit, would mean that that individual's residence could then be searched pursuant to a search warrant.
Well, what about Mr. Brown's answer to me when I said, well, what about the proximity to the residence? How does that factor into your analysis? And he said, when a person has that large amount of drugs and is within a block of his residence, there's a fair inference that he has either just left the residence or is immediately about to return to the residence. So doesn't the proximity of the residence necessarily play some weight in the evaluation?
In perfect candor, Your Honor, I think we are in a different situation if Mr. Moore is, say, for instance, in Southeast D.C. as opposed to in an area near where 118 Sherman was, the address that was searched. I think that is a factor that the court can weigh in making a determination of whether or not probable cause exists within the four corners of the affidavit.
The two troubling things for your case are number one, proximity, and number two, the amount. It's just those two things, the fact that it was $10,000 and the proximity to the home. Given different facts on proximity or amount, you'd have a stronger case, wouldn't you?
Well, the affidavit, in fairness, Your Honor, is not explicit with respect to how close Mr. Moore was to 118 Sherman when it is alleged that the narcotics was discarded. In essence, what the affidavit says is that he was seen in an area close to where 118 Sherman was, and that this is where he first came into contact with Officer Hubley. And that as a result of that initial contact, he ran a distance away and discarded the narcotics. I don't think there's anything in the affidavit that says it with any specificity how far exactly he was from that address when, in fact, these narcotics were discarded. I think what the government would rely upon is the initial contact between Officer Hubley and Mr. Moore, which purportedly took place in the same block as the 118 Sherman address. But again, Your Honor, in connection with that analysis, there's nothing at the time that Officer Hubley comes into contact with Mr. Moore that suggests to Mr. Or Officer Hubley that Mr. Moore is coming from any particular location or is on his way to any particular location. As a matter of fact, at that time when he makes his first interaction with Mr. Moore, there's no indication that Officer Hubley knew where he lived, with the exception of the fact that when he was arrested, he was in possession of a driver's license, which had an address for Malcolm X Drive, which was in Southeast Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and they disclosed that.
That's right, Your Honor.
In the affidavit.
I'm sorry?
That was mentioned in the affidavit.
Yes, Your Honor. And so there was nothing that connected Mr. Moore to that area until obviously they conducted the protective sweep of the 118 Sherman address and had contact with the purported owner of that location. But in putting everything into context, Your Honor, and trying to give this court some idea of where it is that the district court was coming from when making the determination that probable cause did not exist, the requirement that the totality of the circumstances be considered is what I believe the district court was relying upon in making the determination that the probable cause did not exist in this case. Probable cause to believe that Mr. Moore was not only in possession of a large amount of narcotics, but that Mr. Moore was involved with the drug trafficking trade, which would then give rise to the permissible inference. I don't think this court would be saying that any individual found in Baltimore City or Prince George's County, found in possession of an amount of narcotics, would then be subject to have his or her address searched based upon that alone.
I don't read anything that broadly to think that anybody could. These cases tend to rise or fall on very particular facts.
Well,
Judge Keenan had a question for you.
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, just listening to this discussion here really says to me that it's an interesting issue of probable cause. And doesn't that exactly bring to bear the Leon case? You see what I'm saying? Because you've made some good arguments on probable cause, but I really haven't heard from you anything that says why Leon does not apply to this case. I think in your remaining time, it might be helpful for you to
spend
some time on that.
Thank you, Your Honor. As it relates to the Leon application, in essence, our argument would be that the four corners of the document are so lacking as it relates to information supporting the probable cause determination that no officer should rely upon that type of warrant in executing a search. Obviously, it's the state of our law that if, in fact, an officer could reasonably rely upon the information contained in a search warrant and its affidavit, that even if it's found later that the search warrant was impermissible for its lack of probable cause, that the Leon exception would apply. In this case, though, Your Honor, we would hope that the court would find that it is helpful to give direction to law enforcement officers as it relates to the type of information that should be included in an affidavit when requesting a request for a search warrant.
We certainly couldn't say that proximity to a residence and $10,000 worth of discarded drugs equals an objectively unreasonable assessment, could we? I mean, how do we get to objectively unreasonable? That's a pretty high bar.
I think that, you know, first, you would have to also include this, and it's our position that you would have to include this in the context of what was omitted from the affidavit as well. They had an opportunity after they actually were in this location, in this apartment, to inform the magistrate judge of what they either did see or didn't see. That might be information that a magistrate judge, particularly in the context of the absence of the other investigatory techniques that were not present in the affidavit, might have wanted to know. That might have tipped the scales. And it's, I think, mentionable that they left that information out, apparently intentionally. But then, again, Your Honor, we may have disagreement about whether or not those other techniques are required, but the fact that none of them were present should give a law enforcement officer some pause as to whether or not probable cause actually exists in the four corners of this affidavit. And for that reason, we would ask the court to find that the Leon exception does not apply.
Anything further?
If no more questions from the court, I would submit.
We have no further questions. We thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Byron.
Just a couple of points, Your Honors. First of all, regardless of the issue of probable cause, this case should certainly result in a reversal based on the good faith exception. Judge Williams found that the warrant, that the good faith exception didn't apply just based on the third Leon circumstance, that he concluded that the affidavit was so lacking in an issue of probable cause that reasonable reliance on it was not possible. He did not find the first Leon circumstance of a reckless omission. In this case, as Judge Keenan points out, we've had a lively discussion today about whether there was probable cause, and we, of course, believe strongly that there was, based on the information in the affidavit.
You're not conceding that issue.
Not at all. But even if this court were to conclude that we are wrong about that and that the issuing judge was wrong about that, this court has said many times that it's the issuing judge's responsibility to determine whether probable cause exists, and officers cannot be expected to second-guess that determination in close cases. That's a quote from United States versus Mowat from 2008 in this court. And this court avoids applying hyper-technical scrutiny of affidavits lest police officers be encouraged to forego the warrant application process altogether, a point that you made earlier, Judge Wilkinson. That's from the Robinson case from 2001. I take issue with the district court's assessment that this was a weak affidavit, but even if this court were to conclude that the inference of drug dealing wasn't reasonable, it can't be said that that was so clear that the officer should have guessed the issuing judge's conclusion that there was probable cause to search this residence. If there are no further questions, I'll submit at this point. We ask that the court reverse the judgment of the district court and remand this case for trial.
And the probable cause is related to not whether or not he's a drug dealer, correct?
The probable cause is where the district court, I think, the reason it suppressed the evidence was the court found that there wasn't a sufficient nexus between the drugs and the residence, but going into that analysis, Judge Gregory, necessarily is the question of whether he was engaged in drug trafficking, because if he was, then you get to Grossman and the two Williams cases from this.
But the problem is, in this case, though, you have to rely solely on the amount. There was no activity at all observed. that he was involved in what looked to be drug trafficking, correct?
Well, there was no, it is correct that there was no CI buys, nothing like that.
I'm not talking about buys. I'm talking about you can see people coming up to someone. You can't tell what they're doing, but they're making contact. Right. None.
I see your point. There was nothing like that because.
Nothing.
There was nothing like that in the record. However, I disagree with the premise of your question when you said the only thing we're relying on is the amount. We have the amount. We have the proximity. We also.
What's the proximity? And what is it? How many feet, yards?
I'll tell you what it said in the affidavit, right. Which is, this is on Joint Appendix 17. First of all, he first encounters him on the same block as his apartment. And then on the second, the second to last paragraph on Joint Appendix 17, there's discussion of the vehicle. It says the vehicle was parked in close proximity across the street to 118 Sherman Avenue and to where Officer Hubley.
And what does the vehicle have to do with the drug?
Well, the vehicle, this is just in trying to pinpoint as close as possible to where Officer Hubley first encountered him in possession of the drugs.
All right.
So that's where we get the close proximity to the residence. Even if he was just anywhere on the block, obviously it's the same block, our position would be that's very close.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to the inference that we've discussed with Judge Keenan about going to or from. Now, finally.
And then he was stopped for what reason? Or they tried to stop him for what reason?
The officer was investigating a suspected alcohol violation. He had apparently, at least in the affidavit, it says he had something that looked like, an open bottle of alcohol.
Walking down the street.
Correct. And he turns around and initiates some contact, and Mr. Moore doesn't come out to him and talk with him. He just turns around, runs in the other direction.
So police stopped him because he was in his neighborhood with what looked to be a bottle of alcohol?
That's the affidavit says
he must
that
be really busy on 4th of July in Baltimore.
It wasn't Baltimore. It was Tacoma.
I mean, not Baltimore, in Maryland.
Tacoma Park, Maryland.
At Tacoma Park, he must be really busy with people, you know, with alcohol in their neighborhood, stopping people for that reason, right?
Well, first of all, he didn't actually stop him. He didn't get that far. He motioned to him to have, I think, a police citizen encounter. But before it even got that far, Mr. Moore turned around and fled.
And the investigation seems to be neighborhoods sort of targeted in these type investigations. You go from you have drugs, I'm going into your home.
Well,
with no connection to the home at all or car. I mean, I don't know what the limiting aspect of this case is. I think that's what the district court judge looked at. He said no judge, no magistrate, independent could take this and say it's probable cause it connects to his home. That would mean, example, without any kind of trafficking back and forth into his home or some indication, just go into his home.
Well,
and you had already been there and never told the magistrate you had been to that home. Although it was just a protective sweep, it seemed to me that argues against good faith. And a district court judge, who we normally rely upon almost all the time, particularly when they deny a motion to suppress, and make that determination in terms of credibility, in terms of that kind of affidavit, why is it now bereft of any credibility? Because there's connection to his home.
I guess I see my time has expired.
There was no hearing here, so there couldn't be a credibility.
Did you ask for one?
I don't recall if.
I think it's you rest on your briefs. I think the record says.
I don't recall right now if we asked for one, if we had officers there at the time ready to testify.
And whose burden is it to show once it's established that there's not probable cause for the warrant to establish good faith?
I believe it's our burden.
Right, it's the government's burden.
But, and I think we've met that burden here. It's really, you look at this affidavit, it's they squeeze a lot into two or three pages of small print. And there's a lot of detail about the first incident and then the break-in report. And you really would, I think, have to depart in a very significant way from this court's Leon jurisprudence if you found that this was not objectively reasonable for these officers to rely on this warrant, Your Honor. I see my time is now.
Let me just ask my colleagues if they have any further questions.
Thank you very much.
We thank you both.